Well, good morning. Thank you for joining us this morning for our Sunday service. And this morning's Dharma talk will be on the Rai Sambokan, which is contemplation on bowing to the three treasures. And this is coming from the book Important Matters, which I published early last year. So I start out with, I'm not sure about your mind, but if it's anything like mine, it is at times full of all kinds of stuff. There's good stuff and bad stuff and stuff I don't know quite what to do with, though I'm hoping I figure it out soon. When I've taught folks in detox to meditate, almost to a person, the common plea is, I can't get my mind to stop thinking. How can I make it stop? For all those thoughts, there is one truth underlying it all. Our minds contain the three jewels of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. In any single thought moment, your mind encompasses all Dharma qualities and pervades all realms. That's a powerful statement, worthy of deep reflection. What kind of Dharma qualities are in our thoughts? Yes, that's the rub. What kind of Dharma qualities are we manifesting in our thinking? The good, the bad, and the ugly all reflect our Dharma quality. The 10 worlds are always present, and the 10 worlds always have each of the 10 worlds present in some form. So even your bad stuff is Dharma, and so is your good stuff. The key to our practice is not to suppress or hide from those less than admirable thoughts, but to see where they come from, examine them, and then manifest our actions from the mind of the Buddha, from the heart of the Buddha. The principle of the three jewels being present in our one mind is a basis for the sutras. It is not incidental, nor did it arise after the sutras. It is the fundamental truth on which the sutra arose. The Sangha, both in body and in mind, has protected the Buddha Dharma throughout all time and spreads it all over the world and the infinite universe. Trey, do you have your book handy?
Yes, I do.
Okay, do you want to pick up there? I'm on page 22.
Yes.
The second full paragraph, in our own Saha world.
Okay. In our own Saha world, it is we, the common mortals, full of defilements, the curse of thoughts, fleeting attention span, who are tasked with spreading the Dharma. Gods or deities aren't spreading it. It is you and I, with all our imperfections, who are the most qualified to teach the Dharma to others, showing with our lives that there is a way to end suffering and attain enlightenment, as promised in the Lotus Sutra.
Please continue.
It is our minds that the Buddhas respond to. Our minds reveal our true self. It is easy to speak great words. It is exceedingly more difficult to keep the good words in one's mind and heart. One need only consider one's mind and heart to see the answer to why certain things keep occurring, things we don't necessarily wish to keep happening. It isn't an easy exercise, and it isn't always pleasant to reflect on one's mind and heart. It can show some nasty stuff, or at least some undesired stuff that we might rather not see. Yet it's by repeatedly examining this that change begins. Buddhism demands honesty to ourselves. You don't need to bring it out to the attention of anyone except yourself. That's hard enough.
Bill, do you have a copy of the book?
Yes, I do. Do you want me to go get it?
Yes, please.
I have a small apartment.
Yes. No, I understand. I know. Your space is at a premium. So, okay. We'll give it a moment here while Bill goes to get his book.
I'm back.
Okay. Thanks. We're on page 22. Who's cat?
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
Yeah, the dog is playing a little roughly with it.
Oh, it's okay.
So we're at four all?
Yes, please. Go ahead and read that one and on to the next page.
Okay. For all that gunk that hangs around in our hearts and minds, there is something else there. This something else is not to be taken lightly and should never be forgotten. Our minds, while being perceived by the Buddhas, also contain the perception of the Buddhas. Our minds are also the minds of the Buddhas. No matter how bad you may think you are indeed a Buddha and possess the mind of the Buddha within your mind. The trick, as always, is to tap into it while working on lessening those other qualities that work against the Buddha in our lives.
Would you read the quote there, too, also?
Sure. The innumerable great virtues of the Dharma realm is where the three treasures and all human and heavenly beings abide, and what the Dragon King looks up to in reverence. These three treasures are not only of great benefit and win over all sentient beings, but are also of the same nature and entity as us.
Okay, and that quote came from the Shitehoyoshiki. Budanani Nichiki wrote it, and that's on page 391, Shitehoyoshiki. So, what are your thoughts on that? Anybody? Anything you absorbed from that reading? Yes, Trey.
The interconnectedness of everything.
Okay, all right. Interconnectedness of everything, Bill says.
I was going to mention that I noticed that there's a lot there about, you know, how some of these unpleasant aspects are technically part of who we are. It's part of the 10 worlds aspect, and, you know, it shouldn't really be denied or ignored, but recognized and try to figure out where it's from and work with it.
Right, right. You know,
yeah. Meaningful to me.
Yeah, great, wonderful. So when I would teach folks in the detox unit and they'd say, I have all these thoughts going around in my head, what do I do with them? I can't stop thinking. I can't meditate. And that may be your situation at times, that your mind is full of discursive thoughts and just running all over the place. And last week we talked about bringing all the aspects of ourself, all these little things that are all parts of our mind, they're off doing things or, you know, wanting to do things. And some of the examples I use were like buying milk and getting gas in the car and running this errand and that errand. And there's also that aspect of us, but there's also the part of us that maybe thinks less than pleasant thoughts. Maybe we think things that we just wouldn't say out loud to somebody, that we keep hidden in our mind. Those thoughts are there. I don't know anyone who doesn't have those kinds of thoughts. They may be evil thoughts. They may be what we consider evil thoughts. Or maybe they're harmful thoughts. Maybe they're thoughts that that we won't really act upon, but that we think about. And this is all part of who we are. It is a manifestation of all the realms in our lives. And where do they come from? Where do our good thoughts come from? Where do our bad thoughts come from? In the therapy theory, internal family systems theory, they talk about parts of self. So, you know, we use the terms, pardon me, a part of me would like to go to the park today. Another part of me doesn't want to go to the park, but would rather go to the coffee shop. So we speak of ourselves in parts, or a part of me likes that, but another part of me doesn't like that. This is part of our language that we frequently use. But internal family systems theory focuses on connecting. That how do we connect? How do we communicate? What's our core values? So in spite of these thoughts that might be just random, but less than wholesome. We're going to focus on that. The less than wholesome thoughts that we might have. Anybody have those? Occasionally? Okay. Okay, all right, and you know, they aren't necessarily thoughts that we would act upon. They might be fantasy or, you know, just bizarre. Something triggers something in your mind. A movie you're watching or a book you read or, you know, So what do we do with those? How do we use those? How do we defuse those? And by realizing that they are there and they are a part of us, and they are who we are when we bow to the Buddha, when we bow to the three treasures. They come with us. Again, they may not be wholesome. But if we think about how to connect with people and the things we act upon, you know, generally, I've met both Bill, I've met all of y'all in person, so I know you a little bit, and there's not a person among you that I don't think really operates on the principle of connecting with people, compassion for people, concern, caring, all of these things that we want to do to remain part of our group, our family, our friends, our Sangha, all together here today. And those of us, and those who were unable to join us today, Neil sent me an email. I haven't had a chance to read it, but I'm guessing that it contains something to the effect that he wouldn't be able to join us. John is in Sacramento and participating in services at his temple. But I think, and again, I've met all of y'all in person at one time or another. And, you know, there's not a one among you who I don't think really operates basically on the principle of connection. Now, sometimes we get angry and we might say something to push somebody away or to push somebody down. We might say those things. We might even think those things. But generally speaking, where do we operate from? And, you know, celebrating that and also understanding, okay, well, why do I think those kinds of things? Are they things that I would even remotely act upon? Are they just an awareness of a deep, dark part of myself? A deep, dark part of myself that I can't deny, but I don't want to celebrate. Let it be there and be aware of the harmful nature of it. And realize that that is part of our 10 worlds. Even when we're acting on our best behavior, on our most connecting behavior, on our most compassionate behavior, that comes along with us. It's a part of who we are. And to be honest with ourselves and say, I'm not perfect. I'm not better than anybody else. And when we bow to the three treasures, we bring all of these things with us. Without shame. Without fear. Does that make sense? Yes, Bill.
I actually had a... I am not a therapist in any way, shape, or form, but it had me think about if I was, does having the dark thoughts actually help you connect in some way to anybody that you would be offering therapy for that you would not have if you did not have those thoughts?
Yeah.
More of a question is, I guess, how I operate. Something comes up, and it brings in more than any answers. But does it help you if you're doing your therapy to know that you have those thoughts, too, and they're actually acting on it? And that's the problem.
I'm sorry. Could you rephrase the question? I mean,
it helped me. If you have the dark thoughts that we always want to oppress, does it help you relate to the people that actually act on all the dark thoughts?
Well, what do you think? I mean, is that your experience? I think you know you have an answer.
No, really. My experience is actually to avoid such things at all costs to those people. I would shut them out.
Okay.
It's not my job or my part to be therapy, and I don't want any of that on me.
Yeah.
I usually, if I really find out somebody's, I don't want to say vile, but you understand what I mean. If their thoughts are really pretty, pretty bad and I don't want to be associated with them, I disassociate.
Right. So for you, to protect yourself, you pull back. And you view that as a protection for yourself.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And I'm not trying to dissuade you, but you know, I'd be curious about what it is that you feel you're weak in, and you know, what your defense is. I'm not a therapist.
You've done chaplain things, and in some way that helps. You have to have a different connection to people.
Right. Yeah, you know, as a chaplain, you know, I've heard some pretty horrific things. You know, especially, well, I won't say especially in the detox unit, but frequently in the detox unit, I would hear stories of parents who would inject drugs into their children at, you know, at very young ages, 10, 11, 12, addicts who'd done some very, very bad things, less than wholesome things. I've been with criminals in prison, you know, who've done really horrific things. The one person was, the leader of a terrorist group in Africa, and, you know, murdered people, would cut people's arms off just for the fun of it. And to be with those people and understand that, you know, they are human. They lacked whatever it took to become strong against those kinds of dark thoughts. To think about them, the person that was the terrorist in Africa was really a kind, gentle person in a controlled environment. You know, for me, it's understanding that that this is the 10 worlds. We all have them. Some of us are stronger and able to understand that those are not skillful ways of behaving. Those are not wholesome ways of behaving. Those are not compassionate ways of behaving. Some people don't have those tools. And how do we give them the strength to develop those tools? That's my curiosity. That's what I become curious about when I hear these things. What do we do with them? You know, what does that person do with them? And then how can we not cut them off when so many other people have cut them off? You know, those are the things that I become curious about. That's not necessarily everybody's way should be operating. That's not necessarily how Bill should be operating. But for me, that's the way I operate, is how can I be with that person non-judgmentally, you know, without judgment, without prejudice, without an expectation of any kind of behavior? How can I be with that person and perhaps help them explore ways to strengthen, to shore up their defense against those kinds of behaviors? How do I point them in a direction, since I'm not a therapist, how can I point them in a direction that would be healthy for them to pursue future healing? You know? Trey, I think you were going to say something.
I was just taking a note on the, you know, that's a good question. It's like, how do you, you know, if you have this awareness, how can you share it with somebody else? You know, I wrote it down on an index card because I think it's a good one to contemplate on a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, I know in my experience, I have some very interesting friends, we'll just leave it at that, or acquaintances that have, you know, had some pretty rough lives, and I know there have been plenty of situations where no one will have anything to do with them, but I'll talk to them and try to understand kind of where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. And I get it, but it's the same thing. It's kind of how do we share with them some of this insight, or like you're saying, some of these tools or directions, or, you know, help them guide toward something healing. Like, you know, I guess that's what I was trying to think about. And
yeah.
It's a good one, because I think there's a solid answer for everyone, for sure. It's kind of...
You know, when in my life, I've associated with all kinds of less than desirable people, you might say. I mean, you know, with the motorcycle gang in Hawaii. How do I be a Buddhist in that kind of environment? You know, how do I be a Buddhist in hell? It has to be possible. I believe it is. I mean, I've done that. How do we be a Buddhist? You know, it's fine to be a Buddhist in a perfect situation. And that's fine. But not everyone can relate to that, because not everyone lives or has a perfect situation. And so our friends, how do we show them, not just talk about it, but how do we show them? How do we manifest our Buddha nature in hell? And for each of us, that's going to be different. I'm not suggesting that any of you all immerse yourselves in anything that is uncomfortable. You know, I'm not suggesting that you do the things that I've done. You know, I was kind of weird and crazy, and you know, for me it was always important. How can I be good? Is it possible to be good in an environment that is bad or doesn't support good? And again, you know, that would be my definition of good. Not necessarily everyone's definition, but my interpretation of Buddhism. How do I be a Buddha in these realms? You know, we look at the mandala, the Guanzhen, and on either side of... So up at the top, you see four big characters. And then, and let's see, move this hand there. So up at the top, you see four big characters here and at the bottom. And right there in the middle, whoops, right, trying to get my hands. So, okay, I'm coordinating here. So, okay, so that, yeah, how do we, so for the transcript, I was trying to move my hands to get to highlight the characters on the mandala. On the mandala, there's those two characters. One is Aizen, and one is Fudo. And let me get the statues down for you. And so we have... All right. This is going to be kind of weird on the transcript for you, Trey, but maybe you can sort it out. So here's Fudo. Can you see Fudo? Let's see. Put it like this. Oh, is that very good contrast? Can you see Fudo? Oops, he fell off. Sorry about that. So there's Fudo. Fudo sits on a rock, and there's flames coming up around him, and he carries a lasso, a rope with a lasso on it, and a sword, okay? And Fudo stands at the gate, or sits at the gate of hell, and tries to prevent people from entering hell and suffering. And he has a lasso. In case you get in, he can lasso and pull you back out. Okay? This has always been kind of my my patron saint, if you will. How can I prevent people? How can I help people stay out of hell? How can I bring them out of hell? The other character is Aizen. So Aizen. You see Aizen? Got a real fierce face. carrying all kinds of weapons. So he's got, this is a, like a bow here. He's got a, kind of like a mace here. And he's got, let's see, a diamond pounder here, right? Oops, right here. And in this hand, he's empty fist and an arrow here. You see? So Fudo actually goes into hell and does battle with all the demons in hell and tries to rescue people and bring them out of hell. So we have these two characters on the mandala. And Nietzsche doesn't say much about why they're there. The characters on the mandala are esoteric characters. It's interesting that they're there. I find it's interesting. It's curious. We have these deities on there to rescue us and to prevent us from entering into hell and suffering. This is pretty important. These two characters, these two deities are not afraid of being in that environment, understanding that being in that environment is where the people are. So, you know, it's easy for a person who lives a very sheltered, protected life, it's easy for them to look good. It's easy for them, not easy, maybe that would not be best word. But their kind of life is imperceptible. Many people can't see that. You know, the drug addict doesn't see how it's possible to lift their life up from drugs and the environment and maybe prostitution and other things. How do they get out of that and live even, you know, like myself, a relatively stable, well thought out, organized, relatively organized life, controlled environment that, you know, things don't happen to me too randomly. For many people, that's impossible. They can't even see how to do that. They can't even see how to be clean or sober the next day. How do they live the next day with the pain and suffering of a parent who injected drugs into them when they were 10 years old? How do they live the next day with the mental anguish of being abused and beaten and sexually molested from infancy to the present time? How do they live the next day when they have no home? They're on the street, maybe with a cardboard box, if they're lucky. You know, for them to have something like even a house is impossible for them to think about for themselves. It's something that they want, but to achieve it seems impossible. How do we relate to those kind of people? I've been with people who I know are so different from myself, not just because of their previous behavior or their thoughts or their actions. But how do I relate to them that my life is possible in their world? Not the material aspect necessarily, but the joy that I have within myself. And for me, it's always kind of, I mean, you know, with the tattoos and the motorcycle gang and all that stuff, you know, it's easier to do it actually in their world than preach from the outside. Again, I'm not suggesting everyone do that, but it's always been something to me. How do I do this? How do I be a Buddhist and gay and be persecuted. You know, how do I manifest enlightenment as a gay person? You know, that's a pretty heavy mission, especially in the 70s and 80s. How do I manifest Buddhahood with AIDS all around me? You know? And for each of us, we actually have that mission. Bill, how do you manifest Buddhahood as a teacher, as an instructor of martial arts, among people who maybe are taking martial arts for less than wholesome reasons, who come in there with a very angry nature, very aggressive? How do you manifest Buddhahood in that kind of environment? We all have that situation. Trey, you with your friends, some of whom I know a little bit about. Some of them are challenged, even in your own situation, of being a prisoner to your health. You know, how do you manifest Buddhahood and live that example so other people can see it and say, wow, he's like me and he's happy. What are your thoughts?
I guess I would have to, excuse me.
Yes, Trey.
I guess I'd have to say that when I think about it, it seems, as you were saying, quite difficult when you're actually in that state. You know, like I felt probably less like I was manifesting, you know, Buddhahood when I'm going through a really serious health condition or a surgery or whatever than I normally do. So I recognize that. And other problems as well, same thing. When I think about it, I have the same question. How do I? You know, because like you were saying, when things are going smooth or when they're going easy or there's not a lot of trouble, it's very easy to become, you know, like in this place where you're like, okay, I'm all about helping people right now. But yeah, when you're there, you're in all this pain and you're just like so frustrated. It's kind of like, yeah, I'm not concerned about anybody. I'm just thinking about my pain myself. That's not very manifesting Buddhahood.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah, yeah. Bill, did I answer your question?
Creation more that I don't know how to frame.
What's that? What? One more time, please.
And you've created more that I don't know how to frame.
So we're just setting the groundwork for the contemplation on bowing to the three treasures. This is part of who we are. We bring this with us. And for me, I think it's important to understand that these are part of us. And to be able to say, not with pride, and also not with shame. Shame tends to diminish, deny, push away, isolate. You know, to almost cut off a part of ourself because we're ashamed of it. And yet it's there, it's with us. And again, not to celebrate it, not to be prideful of it or anything, but to understand that that is part of who I am. And where does it come from? What's the origin? When we can dig down, and this is part of our enlightenment process, to know ourselves, when we can dig down a little bit and get to the deeper question, what causes, not just why do I think those things, but what is the underlying cause for those things? You know? So, we bring that with us. We bow to the three treasures. And that's sort of the introduction, the preparation for a deeper understanding of the act of contemplating bowing to the three treasures. Okay? Any questions? And Marie and Gerard, I apologize again. This was focused on English, but hopefully you will have a chance to translate the transcript at some point when Trey gets finished cleaning it up. So I'm going to end the recording now, and that will end the transcript. Oh, shucks. Did I not record? Well, I've got a recording of it on the phone. I won't have video, unfortunately. But anyway, so I'm going to end the recording now, and we'll clean it up on the final thing.